prosecution or persecution. So, what just happened? Trial analysis. The trial of Leo Frank was long, expensive, and controversial. And the guilty verdict, unavoidable. As expected, the Frank team quickly collected themselves, retooled, and moved the case through an arduous appeals process involving a dozen courts and, ultimately, the U.S. Supreme Court. That two-year trek is rich in revealing details that open the mystery up to a deeper understanding of the case. Many questions were raised about the initial trial, questions that have not been fully answered or remain unexplored. What follows is a re-evaluation of the overlooked, concealed, and misinterpreted evidence and issues that have plagued the Leo Frank case ever since April 26, 1913. Was Leo Frank a victim of anti-Semitism? The voluminous literature on the Leo Frank murder trial is filled with questions and concerns about the role of James Conley, about the alleged, quote, mob atmosphere, end quote, about the role of prosecutors, and about the fairness of the trial, the testimony, and the evidence. But most prevalent are the allegations by supporters of Leo Frank that the entire affair was driven by anti-Semitic hostility. Or, as the Frank team itself professed, quote, passion, prejudice, and perjury, end quote. Over the years, supporters of Leo Frank have worked zealously and successfully to move anti-Semitism to the center of their narrative, and even make a belief in his innocence a litmus test for the presence or absence of anti-Semitism. Author Steve Oney, for instance, represents most of the writers in the field when he calls the Leo Frank affair, quote, America's worst case of anti-Semitism, end quote. Few have dared to challenge that view, but a far more supportable conclusion is that hatred of Jews or of Judaism was not a motivator or a factor in Leo Frank's prosecution. Rather, the specter of anti-Semitism was more the invention of Frank's supporters and later writers seeking to create Jewish American folklore instead of endeavoring to analyze the facts of the case. Leo Frank was a high official in B'nai B'rith, the most prominent Jewish organization in America. He knew what anti-Semitism looked like and felt like, yet his own assessment of his circumstance was unequivocal. Quote, anti-Semitism is absolutely not the reason for this libel that has been framed against me. It isn't the source nor the result of this sad story. End quote. Frank was being interviewed by the legendary Jewish journalist Abraham Kahn, who was probing him to elicit the opposite response. Frank continued, quote, in a tone of someone deeply convinced. End quote. Quote, if I were an Italian, they would be insightful against me as an Italian. End quote. His Southern-born wife, wrote Kahn, quote, supported her husband's claim, end quote. Though Frank was very clear about the absence of anti-Semitism, B'nai B'rith leaders used the case to energize its newly founded Anti-Defamation League, ADL, dedicated, they claim, to fighting anti-Semitism wherever it emerges. Today, the ADL, like Oney, continues to ignore Leo Frank's own words and insists that the episode is the American manifestation of Hitler's Nazism. At least, it holds that view publicly. Its own internal analysis, performed half a century after the verdict, admits that the mishandling of Leo Frank's defense and the actions of the accused himself were far more significant than any other factor in his conviction. Quote, the defense of Leo Frank was one of the most ill-conducted in the history of Georgia jurisprudence. The defendant made all possible mistakes in handling himself before his arrest. His attorneys completely misunderstood the nature of the evidence against him. His defense was handled by so many people, diverted in so many directions, that it is now impossible to determine responsibility. End quote. The ADL's 1953 assessment diverges widely from the version that it publicly promotes, but its privately voiced candor demands a more critical and nuanced view of the case. There are two facets of the case where anti-Semitism is claimed to have been a factor. First, in the conduct of the case by the prosecutors, who it is said, quote, framed, end quote, Leo Frank, because he was a Jew. And second, among the spectators in and around the courthouse, where, quote, mobs of anti-Semites, end quote, are said to have physically intimidated the judge and the jury. Was Leo Frank framed? The central figure in formulating and prosecuting the case against Leo M. Frank was Fulton County Solicitor Hugh M. Dorsey. It was Dorsey who prepared an impressive cache of damning evidence pointing convincingly to the guilt of Leo Frank. For the case to have been a judicial pogrom, as is claimed, Hugh Dorsey would have to have been the main culprit. After his trial, Frank claimed that Dorsey had corrupted evidence and tampered with witnesses, motivated, he alleged, by political ambition, but not by anti-Semitism. Dorsey's boss at the time was Georgia Governor John M. Slayton. He is considered the white knight of the Leo Frank affair because of his bold decision in 1915 to commute Frank's death sentence to life imprisonment. Before making that decision, he performed his own detailed investigation that included an analysis of the trial. His own report concluded, quote, "The Supreme Court found in the trial no error of law and determined as a matter of law, and correctly in my judgment, that there was sufficient evidence to sustain the," end quote, "guilty," quote, "verdict," end quote. University of California scholar Albert Lindemann authored two books on the history of anti-Semitism and studied several famous trials with implications for the Jewish community. He wrote that, quote, "Even many Jews in Atlanta long remained doubtful about the importance of Frank's Jewishness in his arrest and conviction," end quote. In Dr. Lindemann's view, Dorsey was not an anti-Semite, nor was he operating in a previously existing anti-Semitic climate. Attacks on Jews had not been used in the past to gain popularity or public office. Dorsey had lectured before Jewish civic groups, and when he ran for his position as Atlanta's top prosecutor, 12 Jewish attorneys publicly endorsed him. One of the partners in his law firm was a prominent member of Atlanta's Jewish community. Dorsey's college roommate at University of Georgia was Frank's Jewish attorney, Henry Alexander. Jews across the South were well entrenched in a Jim Crow court system that they helped develop and on which they relied for their everyday business needs. The fact is, the question of Frank's Jewishness went undiscussed and uncommented upon throughout the trial, until Frank's own attorney, Reuben Arnold, a Gentile, made this unsupported claim in his closing argument. Quote, "I'll tell you right now, if Frank hadn't been a Jew, there would never have been any prosecution against him. I'm asking my own people to turn him loose, asking them to do justice to a Jew. And I'm not a Jew, but I would rather die before doing injustice to a Jew," end quote. Dorsey forcefully countered the race card tactic in that part of his closing argument he called a, quote, "tribute to the Jewish race," end quote. Quote, "I say to you here and now that the race from which that man comes is as good as our race. His ancestors were civilized when ours were cutting each other up and eating human flesh. His race is just as good as ours. Just so good, but no better. I honor the race that has produced a," end quote, "Benjamin," quote, "Disraeli, the greatest prime minister that England has ever produced. I honor the race that produced Judah P. Benjamin, as great a lawyer as ever lived in America or England, because he lived in both places and won renown in both places. I honor the Strauss brothers, Oscar the diplomat and the man who went down with his wife by his side on the Titanic. I roomed with one of his race at college. One of his race is my partner. I served with old man Joe Hirsch on the board of trustees of the Grady Hospital. I know Rabbi Marks, but to honor him, and I know Dr., end quote, Ralph A., quote, son of the Hebrew Orphans Home, and I have listened to him with pleasure and pride. But, on the other hand, when, end quote, Charles, quote, Becker wished to put to death his bitter enemy, it was men of Frank's race he selected. Abe Hummel, the lawyer, who went to the penitentiary in New York, and Abe Roif, who went to the penitentiary in San Francisco. Schwartz, the man accused of stabbing a girl in New York, who committed suicide, and others that I could mention, show that this great people are amenable to the same laws as you and I, and the black race. They rise to heights sublime, but they sink to the depths of degradation. End quote. Dorsey's passionate public defense of himself and praise for the Jewish people should have meant the end of his career, if the climate in Atlanta was one of raging anti-Semitism. But the tribute was well received. No howling mob of anti-Semites rebuked him, no threats of lynching or retaliation followed, and the trial proceeded without incident. Leo Frank was indicted by a 23-member grand jury that included five prominent members of the Jewish community. Dr. Lindemann states, quote, "It seems safe to conclude that they were persuaded by the concrete evidence that Dorsey presented, not by his pandering to anti-Jewish feeling." The grand jury met before Conley's testimony against Frank was known, it should be noted. End quote. Lindemann surmised, quote, "Had Frank not been Jewish, but only a northerner or an Italian or a rich man or simply a man with his personal appearance and idiosyncrasies, he still might have been arrested and convicted of the crime." End quote. Most accounts of the Frank affair inexplicably ignore the salient fact that none of those Jewish grand jurors is known to have commented publicly on the case at the time of the massive international Jewish effort to free Frank after the verdict, or in the years following, though their voices would have been supremely significant. Like Frank, the well-known Jewish businessman Oscar Elsass was a client of the law firm of Luther Rosser, and he was known for his oversensitivity to anti-Semitism. He was one of several Jews serving on the panel that decided to indict Frank, and not Conley, for Mary Fagan's murder. This striking Jewish participation in the indictment phase, and before any alleged, quote, frame-up, end quote, could materialize, may help to explain why Atlanta Jews were less conspicuous in their support of Frank throughout the trial. Other points that cast doubt on the charge that anti-Jewish prejudice was a factor in the trial of Leo Frank. Four Gentiles were arrested before Frank was. The detectives from the two private detective agencies Frank himself had hired stated openly before the trial that they believed Frank to be guilty of the murder. An anonymous appeal in 1915 to boycott Jewish merchants of the murder victim's hometown, quote, failed to attract widespread support, end quote, showing that whatever alleged efforts were attempted to inflame Georgians on the basis of, quote, Jew hatred, end quote, were failures. Such calls may even have been angry reactions to the boycotts by out-of-state Jewish businesses that were then underway. Of the more than 100 official complaints that Frank's attorneys filed on appeal of the conviction, not a single one claimed anti-Semitism as a factor in the trial. This is even more striking because Frank's public relations campaign was simultaneously claiming that Frank's treatment in court amounted to anti-Semitic persecution. The United States Supreme Court, which was far out of the reach of the threat of any alleged anti-Semitic mob violence, affirmed the guilty verdict and the death sentence and found no irregularities in the trial. Add to the above facts an editorial in the nation's premier Jewish newspaper, American Israelite, which made important observations in the heat of the battle for Frank's exoneration. Quote, nor should the question of anti-Semitism be put unduly in the foreground. The best Jewish authorities are not satisfied that anti-Semitism played as great a part in this matter as might be supposed. End quote. There is no question that the many white Georgians riveted by the trial believed Frank guilty of a heinous, sexualized child murder, and the trial evidence strongly supports that conclusion. Many among the relatively small group of spectators openly cheered the verdict, as occurred in the O.J. Simpson trial, for instance, but the mendacious claim that anti-Semitism inspired their outburst is unsupportable. Whatever, quote, outbursts, end quote, there were, wrote Stephen Hertzberg, quote, never imperiled, end quote, the Jews, quote, physical security, end quote. By stark contrast, nearly all anti-Black outbursts in this time and region, quote, imperiled the physical security, end quote, of all Blacks. A rumor of murder, thought to have been committed by a Black man, sparked the five-day murderous riot in 1906 in which 50 retaliatory murders of innocent Blacks occurred. In 1913, an actual murder thought to have been committed by a Jewish man sparked a lengthy formal trial. The ADL's assessment is accurate. Leo Frank and his team of defenders made a series of missteps and blunders, in and out of court, that harmed him irreparably. Frank's attorney, Reuben Arnold, hardly endeared himself to the masses when he described those who believed his client guilty as, quote, ignorant, end quote. In court, he referred to the audience as, quote, that gang of wolves, end quote, and characterized a white employee of Frank's who had testified against him as, quote, the ugliest, dirtiest reptile, end quote, whose, quote, habitat was in the filth, end quote. Luther Rosser walked a fine line when he took on his former law partner, the trial judge. Quote, the trial was a farce and not in any way a trial. In saying this, we do not make the least criticism of Judge Roan, who presided. End quote. He, quote, is one of the best men in Georgia and is an able and conscientious judge. End quote. Similarly, some of Frank's Jewish supporters were just as callous as Arnold in their views of the poor victim, Mary Fagan. The New York Sun reported, quote, some Jews were credited with saying that even if Frank did kill Mary Fagan, she was nothing but a factory girl. End quote. The trial record tells the story of an apparent coldness on the part of the wealthy Jews in the midst of a shocking tragedy. The morning after the murder, quote, Mr. Frank and his wife came over to Mrs. Ersenbach's on Sunday after we had breakfast about 9 o'clock. End quote. Annie Hickson, the Black maid of Frank's in-laws, testified. Quote, they come over there every Sunday. I didn't pay any attention to what they talked about that morning. They were just laughing and talking like they always do. Yes, he laughed. They were all laughing together. He wasn't nervous or excited so far as I could see. Nothing unusual about him. Don't know what they were laughing about. End quote. Georgians and the Fagan family must have resented those callous attitudes. Thomas Watson spoke for the Georgian people. Quote, only a factory girl. That's what the papers kept on saying. Yes, she was only a factory girl. There was no glamour of wealth and fashion about her. She had no millionaire uncle. She had no Athens kinspeople ready to raise $50,000 for her. She had no mighty connections to wield influence, muzzle newspapers, employ detectives, and manufacture public sentiment. Only a factory girl. End quote. Leo Frank's anti-Semite for hire. Thomas B. Felder. Quote, I know who killed Mary Fagan. That damned Jew Frank killed her. And I have known it for 3 weeks. End quote. Thomas B. Felder, a Frank employee. The absence of anti-Semitism in the official trial of Leo Frank does not mean that it was totally absent from the events associated with the Atlanta tragedy. We know that Thomas Watson's entry into the case in 1914, a half year after the trial, brought with it an upsurge in white Jewish-Gentile tensions. And his participation will be covered in a later chapter of this study. But a lesser-known chapter in the early stages of the case is where we find the first signs of publicly expressed anti-Jewish bigotry. Just 3 weeks after the murder of Mary Fagan came the awkward entry into the case of a well-heeled Georgia-born attorney named Thomas B. Felder. At 48, Felder was a Mason, an Elk, and a one-time mayor of Dublin, Georgia. He had earned the honorific title Colonel by his fidelity to Southern traditions, and along with his socialite wife, he was a stalwart member of high Southern society. So when he entered the fray, claiming to represent the lower working-class friends and family of Mary Fagan, it raised more than a few eyebrows. Even with his insider status and local renown, Colonel Felder's presence seemed strangely out of the blue. He went about soliciting donations from the public, he claimed, to hire a professional detective agency, quote, to get to the bottom, end quote, of the tragedy, and to ensure that poor Mary received justice. By this time, Leo Frank was in custody and considered the only suspect, and he was only moments away from being formally indicted. The Atlanta Police Department had made the case its highest priority, as did the office of prosecutor Hugh Dorsey. Aiding them were the internationally acclaimed Pinkerton detectives hired by Frank himself, and all felt confident in their conclusion that Leo Frank murdered Mary Fagan. But Felder insisted that yet a fourth investigative force was necessary, namely the Pinkerton rival William J. Burns Detective Agency. Felder drew yet more suspicion when the first donors to his public fundraising effort were revealed to be wealthy Jews, most notably the industrialist and Chamber of Commerce official William J. Lowenstein, and cotton merchant and philanthropist Joseph Hirsch. Mary Fagan's Marietta neighbors, whom Felder claimed to represent, were not among the donors. In fact, when they were asked about their relationship to their self-declared savior, Mary's family disavowed Felder, claimed to have rejected his offers of assistance, and continued to express their full confidence in the police. Felder's maneuverings soon backfired when the police lured him into a meeting with hidden microphones recording the session. They caught Felder offering a bribe of $1,000 to a police official for documents related to the Frank case, about $25,000 in today's money. Felder, believing he was holding a private conversation, explained his motivation. Quote, "This damned fellow," end quote, Police Chief of Detectives Newport, quote, "Lanford, knows that Frank killed this girl, but he has sold out to the Jews for big money, which he is getting and has got, in his effort to protect this damned Jew," end quote. Felder's intemperate fulminations were all being secretly transcribed in the next room, and were soon exposed on the front pages of all the Atlanta dailies. With the city spotlight now on him, Felder amplified his anti-Jewish posture, continuing to profess that his only desire was to get at the truth of the murder of young Mary Fagan. Anti-Semitism would become the central theme of the Frank case for the next century, but Felder's open bigotry, just 3 weeks after the crime, was actually the first recorded expression of it. What should have been the most obvious and open proof that anti-Jewish bigotry did indeed infect the case was met with a suspiciously muted response. Frank's friends and defenders seem to ignore Felder's anti-Jewish rant, as do the army of pro-Frank writers who have taken the case on as a Jewish cause celebre. In fact, wrote the Georgian, there is good reason for their self-imposed gag order. Quote, it had been believed that, end quote, Felder, quote, really was in the employ of the Frank defense up to the time that he began to bombard the public with statements against Frank and went on record in saying he believed in the guilt of Frank, end quote. The Georgians' hunch that Felder was indeed a Frank hire was very likely correct, and Felder's blustery descent into anti-Jewish bigotry may have been a ruse by the defense team to gain access to the prized police documents that might help in Frank's cause. Roger Hunkanen was the researcher for Harry Golden's book, A Little Girl Is Dead. In private correspondence, he wrote to Golden that Felder was pretending to be pro-police and anti-Frank, even making wild statements against the Jews of Atlanta. This was to cover the fact that he was actually working for Frank, as nearly as I can figure, in bringing in the Burns detectives. Several things point strongly to that conclusion. Leo Frank and his legal team became strongly dissatisfied with the performance of Pinkerton agent Harry Scott, who had shown himself to be true to Frank's own publicly stated charge, quote, to aid the local officers in the search for the man responsible for the brutal murder, end quote. In Frank's mind, Scott took that announcement far too literally. By this time in the investigation, the Pinkertons detective agency had become fully convinced of Frank's guilt. This, of course, had to be disturbing to Leo Frank and the Montags. The Pinkertons were paid by the National Pencil Company, not by the taxpayers. They were expected to protect Frank, not prosecute him, irrespective of the superintendent's public pronouncements. That put Frank in a serious quandary. He had to shut down his own detective agency and find another, more cooperative one, but without suggesting to the public or the police that the Pinkertons had performed unsatisfactorily. Thomas Felder was just the kind of character who could appear as an independent agent, make noise about the inadequacy of the investigation and the shielding of, quote, the Jew, end quote, and bring in the Burns agency to, quote, get to the bottom, end quote, of it all. It was a bold, arrogant, and thoroughly ill-conceived scheme that was put into motion even before its perpetrators secured the cooperation of the victim's family, the scheme's alleged beneficiaries. Also, in his law practice, Felder had a strangely niched clientele, as described by Steve Oney. Felder, quote, had floated into Atlanta society on a veritable stream of alcohol. Just how many breweries, distilleries, distributors, and bar owners the colonel counted as clients is uncertain. 40 was the number critics bandied about. But what it all added up to was an undeniable reality. Felder was the city's reigning liquor lawyer. End quote. In the 2014 book, Jews and Booze, Becoming American in the Age of Prohibition, author Mamie Davis impresses upon her readers that the business of booze was a Jewish specialty, especially in the South. Thus, Felder's clients were very likely Jewish businessmen in Leo Frank's social network. Indeed, standing by, waiting in the wings for Felder's ill-fated dock drop was, quote, a committee of citizens, among whom were Mr. Hirsch, Mr. Myers, Mr. Greenstein, and several other prominent Jews in this city, end quote. If there were a moment in the case when Georgia's anti-Semites were almost forced to make their presence felt, Felder provided it. Yet no one, not a single person, seconded Felder's anti-Jewish emotion. Felder's calculated rage about, quote, a Jewish plot, end quote, was memorialized in a legal affidavit. And though the Atlanta Journal fully quoted it, the Georgian and the Constitution chose only to summarize Felder's remarks in a much softened form. And incredibly, not a single Jew came forward to decry the overt and open bigotry so audaciously spewed by this prominent Georgian. Scholars of the case seem anxious to ignore the Felder affair, if they bring it up at all. In just a few months hence, Felder could be found throughout the newspapers unscathed, enmeshed in the hot and heavy mix of white Georgia politics. In retrospect, it seems evident that Felder had worked on behalf of Frank and his Jewish supporters to obtain valuable inside information about the murder investigation. The mystery of whom Felder worked for, if there ever was any doubt, seemed to be solved about a year after that debacle, when the home of esteemed Jewish industrialist and National Pencil Company shareholder Oscar Pappenheimer burned down. According to the Atlanta Journal, May 31, 1914, quote, "The entire Pappenheimer family went to the home of Thomas B. Felder for the remainder of the night," end quote. Injecting anti-Semitism into the trial. The Brent-Kendley Affair. Once the Felder commotion died down, the highly anticipated trial of Leo Frank got underway on July 28, 1913. As previously shown, Frank suffered several early setbacks when his racism-based defense strategy was overpowered by the weight of the unshakable, quote, "Negro testimony," end quote, of night watchman Newt Lee and factory sweeper James Conley. By the midway point, it was dawning on Frank's attorneys that the legal route to their client's exoneration was fast closing, and that other avenues and escape routes would have to open if Frank's life were to be spared. The ever-attentive Atlanta Journal reporter noted a shift in the Frank defense tactics after Conley's, quote, "ingenious narrative," end quote, was disclosed in court. Quote, "The defense is evidently playing for position in the event the jury returns a verdict against Frank. Both attorneys Rosser and Arnold have daily entered many objections and taken many exceptions which they ask to be noted in the record. This is understood to mean that they are paving the way for an application to the Supreme Court for a new trial in case the verdict is adverse to their client," end quote. Remarkably, that very same edition of the Journal carried another front-page story with the headline, quote, "Witness found who saw Mary Fagan on way to factory," end quote. This new witness was a trolley conductor named George Kendley. He claimed that on the day of the murder, he finished his shift and boarded another car, whereupon he saw Mary Fagan walking down Forsyth Street a short distance from the National Pencil Company. He was sure of this, he said, because he had known Mary and her stepfather, J.W. Coleman, for years. Thus, a full 14 weeks after the crime, a family friend suddenly emerges with critical eyewitness testimony of the events leading up to the murder. That was fishy enough, but the next series of coincidences seemed to have the fingerprints of the ever-scheming counselors of Leo Frank. Through the fortuitous introduction of George Kendley, Frank's attorneys executed a slick legal maneuver by which they manufactured anti-Semitism where none existed, and artificially created the anti-Semitic storyline that now permeates every retelling of the case. Kendley was called as a prosecution witness to establish the timeline of the tragedy, given the particular importance of timekeeping to performing his job. This is key because Frank's lawyers were disputing the state's timeline and insisting that Mary arrived at the factory several minutes later, making it impossible for Frank to have committed the murder. But his testimony was oddly ineffectual. Quote, "I saw Mary Fagan about noon on April 26th. She was going to the pencil factory from Marietta Street. The time that I saw her is simply an estimate. I remember seeing her by reading of the tragedy the next day. I know I saw her before 12:05. I couldn't swear it was exactly on the minute," end quote. Kendley's indecisive testimony actually assisted the alibi of Leo Frank. Kendley was dismissed by Dorsey, but his testimony was now in the official trial record. And here is where Frank's attorneys went into action. Despite his courtroom gift for the Frank defense, Kendley yet became the target of a particularly vicious attack by the same team of attorneys that sat mute when a parade of women and girls dragged their client's reputation through the proverbial mud. They ignored his testimony about Mary's arrival time and instead called to the stand a Mr. T.Y. Brent, who testified that, "I have heard George Kendley on several occasions express himself very bitterly towards Leo Frank. He said he felt in this case just as he did about a couple of Negroes hung down in Decatur. That he didn't know whether they had been guilty or not, but somebody had to be hung for killing those streetcar men, and it was just as good to hang one nigger as another. And that Frank was nothing but an old Jew, and they ought to take him out and hang him anyhow." Kendley very feebly denied that he had ever used this language. But his alleged threats of religious violence against Frank became the doorway through which the issues of both lynching and anti-Semitism entered the official trial record. By trial rules, only the issues and subjects raised through witness testimony could be discussed in the courtroom. Kendley's official appearance on the witness stand for the prosecution gave the Frank defense the right to impeach him and his veracity. They brought Brent in for that purpose, and he told of his alleged anti-Semitic encounter with Kendley, thus opening the door for Leo Frank to play the, quote, religion card, end quote, in a case where Frank's religion had never been an issue. So fortuitous was this second gift for Leo Frank that one must reasonably conclude that Brent and Kendley were planted witnesses by the Leo Frank defense team. Kendley gave unexpected testimony that was critical to sustaining Frank's alibi. It was later revealed that T.Y. Brent was not a disinterested bystander, randomly riding the trolley one day. He actually worked for the Leo Frank defense team. He states, quote, "I have been employed by the defense to assist in subpoenaing witnesses. I took the part of Jim Conley in the experiment conducted at the factory on Sunday." End quote. Incredibly, Brent not only participated in the defense's crime scene reenactment, but also appears early on in the case when Newt Lee was being interrogated by police. Brent, it seems, was Lee's former employer, and upon hearing that his former watchman was in custody, he went down to the police station to, quote, volunteer, end quote. This is where Brent entered the case and probably began his association with the Frank defense team. Two other witnesses besides Brent claimed to have, quote, overheard, end quote, Kendley's rant. One S. L. Asher said he had heard Kendley making anti-Semitic remarks, adding, quote, "I took his number down to report him," end quote. On cross-examination, though, he admitted that he had filed no such report. The other witness was a Miss C. S. Haas, who said, quote, "I heard Kendley 2 weeks ago talk about the Frank case so loud that the entire streetcar heard it," end quote. She continues with an oddly worded non sequitur that had lasting consequences. Quote, "He," end quote, Kendley, quote, "said that circumstantial evidence was the best kind of evidence to convict a man on, and if there was any doubt, the state should be given the benefit of it, and that 90% of the best people in the city, including himself, thought that Frank was guilty and ought to hang," end quote. That strange recounting of Kendley's alleged tirade just so happens to have the dual purpose of confirming Kendley's anti-Semitism and placing doubt in the jurors' minds about the credibility of, quote, circumstantial evidence, end quote. Those are two points that Frank's attorneys surely wanted the jurors to consider, but trial rules forbade them from raising. That this testimony comes from a woman named Haas, the same last name as Frank's main attorneys, Leonard and Herbert Haas, only adds to its improbability. This little episode, with its collusion of dubious witnesses and questionable events, that, for the first time, allows Frank's religion to be considered in the courtroom, was clearly more than accidental. Frank's attorney, Reuben Arnold, snatched the baton from Kendley, quote, the Jew hater, end quote, and ran the anchor leg in his closing remarks. Quote, "They are fellows like that streetcar man, Kendley, the one who vilified this defendant," end quote, Frank, quote, "here, and cried for him to be lynched and shouted that he was guilty, until he made himself a nuisance on the cars he ran. Why, I can hardly realize that a man holding a position as responsible as that of a motorman, and a man with certain police powers, and the discretion necessary to guide a car through the crowded city streets, would give way to passion and prejudice like that." It was a type of man like Kendley who said he did not know for sure whether those Negroes hanged in Decatur for the shooting of the streetcar men were guilty, but that he was glad they hung as some Negroes ought to be hanged for the crime. He's the same sort of a man who believes that there ought to be a hanging because that innocent little girl was murdered, and who would like to see this Jew here hang, because somebody ought to hang for it. I'll tell you right now, if Frank hadn't been a Jew, there would never have been any prosecution against him. I'm asking my own people to turn him loose, asking them to do justice to a Jew. And I'm not a Jew, but I would rather die before doing injustice to a Jew. End quote. What may confirm this Kendley incident as a true concoction is the fact that at almost this precise moment in the trial, members of the B'nai B'rith were meeting secretly with the editor of the Atlanta Constitution about a controversial advertisement they wanted to place in the paper. That ad argued that Frank was being prosecuted not because of his guilt, but because of his religious faith. Burton Rasko reveals this in his book on the Leo Frank case. Quote, "When the advertisement was shown to," end quote, "Jacob," quote, "Dewey Gortatowski, then managing editor of the Atlanta Constitution, the most influential newspaper in the South, and himself an Orthodox member of Frank's religious faith, Mr. Gortatowski strongly advised the committee not to publish the advertisement. He reminded them that 5 members of the grand jury which had indicted Frank were of Frank's own religious faith. He said that they had no evidence upon which to base their assertion, and that no question of race or religion had been raised by the prosecution, and that it would have made Solicitor General Dorsey's job much easier if the grand jury had indicted Conley instead of Frank, because Conley was not only a Negro and thus disfranchised and declassed, but a Negro with a police record, dissolute, shiftless, and without friends or money. He said the advertisement would inflame morons and create prejudice where no prejudice existed, inasmuch as it accused a reputable and respectable state official, Hugh M. Dorsey, of gross dereliction of duty, and that the advertisement, moreover, attempted to try the case and free Frank before the jury had heard all the evidence. Mr. Gortatowski intimated that the advertisement might prove inimical to their friend's interest, but the committee of Frank's friends went ahead and inserted the advertisement anyhow." End quote. Rasko goes on to say that the group became the Leo M. Frank Defense Fund Committee, of which Herbert Haas, attorney for the National Pencil Company, was chairman. They, quote, "began to solicit funds on a national and international scale, alleging that Frank was a martyr condemned by religious prejudice," end quote. The defense team's deliberate injection of anti-Semitism into the trial proceedings did not escape the notice of prosecutor Hugh Dorsey, who, in his own closing argument, made sure the jury was made fully aware of the sleight of hand that took place right under their noses. Quote, "But, the first time it was ever brought into this case, and it was brought in for a purpose, and I have never seen any two men manifest more delight or exultation than Messrs. Rosser and Arnold, when they put the questions to George Kendley at the 11th hour, a thing they had expected us to do, and which the state did not do because we didn't feel it," end quote. Anti-Semitism. Quote, "And because it wasn't in this case. I will never forget how they seized it. I will never forget how they seized it. Seized with avidity the suggestion. And you know how they have harped on it ever since. Now, mark you, they are the ones that mentioned it, not us. The word never escaped our mouth." End quote. So, to recap. Trolley conductor George Kenley shows up 3.5 months after the murder of a family friend, claiming to be a witness to the exact time of the victim's arrival at her workplace, but becomes foggy-brained under oath. He has a shameful public episode in which he spews anti-Semitic invective that he has trouble under oath remembering or denying, at the exact same moment that T.Y. Brent, a Frank legal team employee, is riding that same trolley, along with two other Jewish people, one of whom has family ties to Frank's lead attorneys, who are at that same moment assembling and meeting with the Jewish leaders to seek ways to make a non-existent anti-Semitism the centerpiece of the Leo Frank trial. And the random result is that Kenley's name is used unsparingly by Leo Frank partisans to do exactly what the Haases had intended: change a lawful trial proceeding into a violent anti-Semitic persecution of Leo Frank. Dinnerstein points out the obvious. Quote, "The remarks attributed to the trolley conductor were less important for their content than for the attitudes expressed. It was the first time that any indication of overt anti-Semitism appeared in the court." End quote. Be with us again next time when we present the next chapter of The Secret Relationship Between Blacks and Jews, Volume 3. The Leo Frank Case, The Lynching of a Guilty Man. Prepared by the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam, Chicago, Illinois. Copyright 2016 by Latimer Associates. All rights reserved. Published in audiobook form by the American Mercury with permission of the Historical Research Department of the Nation of Islam.